The SEND Network podcast is brought to you by the SEND Network, a digital community for SEND practitioners to connect and collaborate. To find out more, head over to send-network.co.uk. Hello, welcome to the SEND Network podcast. Today's episode is a Neurodiversity Celebration Week special, and I'm delighted to be joined by the wonderful Cheryl Warren. Cheryl is the founder and director of Aperion Training, where she provides support for professionals to create inclusive and inspiring environments. Cheryl also recently started Not Your Typical Podcast, which we claim was inspired by her appearance on season one of the SEND Network podcast, which focuses on all things neurodiverse in early years. Cheryl, thank you for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for having me. And yeah, I'll let you take that one. That's not a problem.
good. And in today's episode, we're going to be discussing Neurodiversity Celebration Week, including the importance of moving from awareness to acceptance and celebration of neurodiversity, and how to become a neuroaffirming Senko and educator. So we'll start off part one, Neurodiversity Celebration Week. So Cheryl, what is Neurodiversity Celebration Week, and why is it important to celebrate neurodiversity?
Good place to start, and I'm absolutely very, very excited that we are sharing this out on such a special week, and obviously a week very close to my heart. Neurodiversity Celebration Week started in 2018 by a lady from the UK called Sienna. And as an autistic student, also dyslexic, dyspraxic, and ADHD, having experienced lots of challenges and prejudice growing up as a neurodivergent individual, she just felt that there had to be something, there had to be a different narrative. And she founded Neurodiversity Celebration Week. And really, it's a coming together of individuals, of trainers and professionals and experts and parents and neurodivergent adults to really share their story and really highlight the strengths and celebrate all of these differing neurotypes and the impact that they're having on the world, the impact that they're having on their local communities and local society. And then in turn, prompt that shift in narrative, that shift from neurodiversity conditions being a problem to actually accepting our individuals, seeing their strengths, and ensuring that we are celebrating everything that everybody brings to society. And certainly from a neurodivergent perspective, that again, you know, I speak a lot about difference being a deficit and a problem, and this really is a week to say no. I mean, it shouldn't just be a week, to be honest, but it is that week to say no. We will celebrate, we will learn, and we will celebrate what these amazing autistic voices, ADHD brains are informing us about these differing neurotypes, and they should be celebrated.
Summed it up perfectly there. I mean, we want to talk about why it's so crucial to move from awareness to acceptance. So it'd be maybe a good way to go around this would be to explain like how it feels for neurodiverse children, you know, in an environment that doesn't fit their needs or how, you know, their brain works. How does that feel, and why should we be accepting that difference instead of just, you know, sort of raising a bit of awareness and maybe thinking about it once a year?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've mentioned before that we're all, if we just take autism, for example, as one of, you know, as a neurodivergent condition, we've all been on autism awareness courses. They've been around for a long, long time. And generally, when I'm out talking to people, I ask anybody who's been on one of those courses, and the majority do raise their hand. But for me, it's one thing being aware of it. We're all aware. We're all very aware. If we just kind of focus from it on autism, we're all aware of it. But we have to shift that awareness to now going, okay, well, I'm aware, so let me know more, let me learn more. But then still, we're not doing enough. And for me, we then have to shift to that acceptance, because accepting means action. And then we can create amazing spaces for our children because we have understood and learnt all that we need to know to provide those safe spaces for our children. And it's crucial that we do. There are so many children being let down and being failed by the current education system. I posted something on LinkedIn just less yesterday from an article that came out of children that are being completely failed because they are not providing those accommodations and those adaptions. They are not considering the environment. They are not looking at the behaviors in front of them and thinking, why is that child behaving that way? What could be the trigger for that child? And therefore, okay, what do I need to do as the adult to ensure that that child isn't having a high anxiety driven meltdown because their needs are being met? So it's accommodating for those differing needs. We all have equal opportunities policy. We all have special educational needs and disability policy. But those policies have to be actionable and those actions have to be carried out. The amount of times I've heard of parents who have eventually got a support plan in place for their child, whether that's an IEP within the setting or that's an EHCP, which has, more kind of force behind it, if you like. And certainly within in school environments, teachers are just not following those things through. There is a big push at the moment. There is a big group of parents that have brought together and called themselves, it's the Send Reform. And they are lobbying Parliament and saying, you are failing our children. Our children are not in school. And it's not that our children are school refusers. They are not refusing to go to school. They would be at school, but you are creating barriers to education. And it's that one size fits all. And we need to shift the narrative and the expectation around not one size does not fit all. I mean, take my children, for example. My oldest son's autistic, my youngest son's dyslexic. Their brains work differently. Their brains process things differently. My children respond to things and situations very, very differently. Adapt and accommodate to ensure that they are provided with a safe space where they can thrive within that environment. But the only way that we can do that is to shift that narrative to acceptance, to say, right, I accept that their brain works differently. So they're going to need some fidgets. They're going to need a sensory diet. They're going to be needing the option to stand up for story time or have a standing desk or go and sit by themselves to work on a project by themselves because they really struggle actually in small group work that triggers them. So yeah, that's okay. We're going to set that up. Or actually, it's really difficult for them to sit on a chair. So let's provide them with a gym ball so that they can be bouncing up and down on the gym ball. I wrote a blog a little while back called My Messy Classroom. And they are the best classrooms for me, the ones where children are kind of here, there, and everywhere, but they are all completely engaged in what's going on. They're just not necessarily complying. And I think certainly from our school's perspective, it's about compliance over connection. And we do it so well in early years. We really, really do. We follow children's interests, we follow their lead. But we just need to understand that little bit more that maybe if they're not, why are they not? And understanding their play and their behaviors and accepting that that's okay. That's all right if they play differently. It's okay if they behave differently or respond differently. How can you support them to thrive, to feel safe, to be included within your space? So yeah, it's shifting that awareness to acceptance because acceptance for me comes with action.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, moving to acceptance, a part of that is also, I mean, celebrating the differences as well. And actually, there are thousands of benefits to having people that think differently to neurotypical people. So tell me, what can a school do to better celebrate and advocate for its neurodiverse students?
I think for me, it's opening up that narrative, isn't it? If you had a wheelchair user in your early year space, in your nursery, in your reception class, children would be asking questions because children do. Children are curious. Children are inquisitive. Why is that child in that wheelchair? Why has that child got, big glasses on. Why has that child? One of my son's friends is just about to have an eye patch to strengthen his weak eye. There are going to be loads of questions around why this child has his eye patch. And I am sure that the teachers in my son's class, with permission from my son's friend's mum, that they will be happy to answer those questions. And you know, certainly for my son's friend, he's 9, he will be able to articulate why he's got that on. And he will say, because I've got, he's always worn glasses. Well, I've got one bad eye, so my patch is on my good eye so that it makes the other one stronger, a bit like building my muscles when I'm at the gym. I want to build my other muscles up in my eye to make them stronger so I can see. And the children will go, all right then, okay, and that's fine. So it's about opening up the dialogue to hidden disabilities. And there was that dialogue and that kind of reframing of things very, very briefly during COVID with the sunflower lanyards, and you see it now on you know, I'm in London and we go on the tube and it says, you know, not all disabilities are visible. Be aware of what might be going on for people, you know, getting on and off the train. So it's opening up that dialogue, and I hear it often, well, we can't have fidgets for Johnny because then everybody will want the fidget. That child needs that to be able to be open and have the opportunity for everything that that school provides. So their full curriculum offer. So my son, again, my son's school, there's a little boy in a wheelchair. He does donuts in the playground and everybody gives him claps, and he's completely immersed in the school space. And it's opening up that dialogue around these hidden disabilities so that we can, you know, educate ourselves if we don't know, but also educate the next generation so that we are not having to have weeks potentially like this where we highlight it, because it's just what we do. It's understanding and accepting all of those differences. There is a great range of books out by a lady called Gemma Kerr called The Abilities in Me. But she has written a series of books on different disabilities and different conditions. So when I go on my on and deliver my training courses, I take them with me. I have one on autism, ADHD, dyslexia, and sensory processing disorder. If those books are in our book corners, they're children's books. If they're in our book corners and children are just picking them up and reading them to each other, we are starting that dialogue and that narrative with our youngest children. And the more we can have those open, honest, and transparent conversations and answer children's questions, it will be, oh, okay, yeah, well, I know that actually I can focus okay on the piece of work that I've been given or this task that I've been given. So maybe I don't need a fidget, but I know that George over there, he has a brain where he just needs a little bit more help with some focus for him to be able to finish the job. So he has got a fidget and a squidgy ball because that's going to help him complete the creative writing task that we're doing or whatever it is. Children are curious, they are inquisitive, and the earlier we can have these open and honest conversations about difference, then surely the next generation will see that difference is okay and not a deficit.
100%, 100%. Yeah, it's about normalizing it.
I think what it also will do is take away that stigma. You know, there's lots of you know, conversations I have with people about working and supporting parents. I know we're not going down that route today, but just quickly. And I think there is still this kind of dread and fear that, you know, I'm not going to open up to you around a conversation that my child may have a neurodivergent condition because it's seen as a problem. But if we can have the narrative running through our earlier settings, that's going to feed back to the parents. So those parents are potentially going to be more open to have those conversations with you. And it just benefits everybody, surely. That can't just be me. Surely that must make it better for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And last time we phoned, you were wearing a jumper that said, well, remind me what it said on your jumper.
It said, I wore it at Expo last weekend, Neurodiversity Affirming Mum Club.
There we go.
Yes,
I love it.
big bold letters on the back and a little bit on the front.
And I mean, that's what we're sort of going to be talking about now is about being a neuroaffirming Senko educator. So What does that mean for anyone that doesn't know?
So being neuroaffirming really is saying, I get it, I understand, I know that there are differences, and I am going to positively affirm those differences. So, I mean, being a neuroaffirming practitioner runs through absolutely everything that we do, and that narrative that runs through everything that we do within the nursery setting or within the school setting. But it's really having that strength-based approach. It's saying that we see the positives. We understand that there are challenges. It's not saying there are no challenges. Yes, there are challenges, but we are coming from a strength-based perspective. So, and it's ensuring that from that acceptance we affirm, and then through everything that we do, we're saying we are validating exactly who you are. And what we are doing is providing an environment where you can be your true, authentic self. You are not having to mask. You are not having to be somebody that you are not. We are not using strategies or interventions that are there to be seen to fix or cure you of your neurodivergent condition to make you more neurotypical. We are saying who you are is exactly who you should be, and you are flipping amazing right as you are. So it's about if we understand neurodivergent play, it's about joining in with that play, following the child's lead, not expecting them to play in a very neurotypical way because we think that's the correct way to play. It's saying, do you know what? The way that you line things up, the way that you categorize things, the way that you section things off, the way that your play is repetitive, the way that your play is very heavily linked to your clear schemas and your patterns of play, or clearly linked to your sensory needs, including stimming and things like that. You're including all of that in your play. Brilliant. I'm going to come and play right with you to validate and affirm the way that you play. And I'm not going to stop you stimming unless it's dangerous. It's a dangerous stim, in which case, yes, we need to have that dialogue but we also have to provide that alternative, because there is a clear need for that stim or that sensory play. So it's providing that environment that is low arousal, that offers choice and autonomy for our children, that is aware of the sounds and the volume and the smells and what we are asking our children to, or providing our children to eat or to play and touch with. Are we providing them with those, again, those accommodations and those adaptions so that they can have full access to our curriculum offer? So if you have noticed, if you've done some observations and you've noticed that a child does kind of skip from one activity to another, and they never go near the messy play, don't kind of think, oh, okay, well, they're never going to access messy play then. They don't like messy play. Oh, okay. Or no, we need to get them used to it. So let's go and kind of pour some water or gloop over their hands because they'll get used to it after a while. It's understanding that the sensory needs for many of our children, it's not that they won't do something, it's that they can't. And there is a difference. So let's think about, okay, so rather than the child has to change because we always have the gloop or the Play-Doh or the sand out, so they have to adapt and they have to just join in with what we've got. It's about saying, okay, what can I do as the adult? How can I shift it? Okay, might it be that I provide some gloves for that child to be able to touch the gloop? Might it be that I give them a smaller bowl or a pot by themselves so they're not concerned about the other children splashing it onto them? Could it be that I just provide them with a couple of wooden spoons to play and manipulate the corn flour so they don't get messy? It doesn't take much, but it's providing those adaptions and those accommodations. It's focusing on your narrative. What does it say in your policy? Again, is the common thread that the child needs to change, or that actually you are providing and validating for that child? What do your displays say? If your child never does creative play, how are they depicted in your display boards around? How is their journey in their early years space shown so they feel that there is that kind of sense of belonging, that they can see themselves and what they've done up on the boards? It's that adaptability and flexibility in routine, but it's also about that narrative that runs through some of the things that we say. You know, that child is refusing to do it, or they're never going to be able to do that, or, you know, George isn't very good at following directions or refuses to follow directions. It's shifting that narrative. So if we have got George who is, and the narrative is he's refusing to follow directions, I'd shift that to, okay, what makes following that direction really difficult for George? So therefore, what do I need to do to make it easier and available for George? But it's just that understanding the child in front of you, their sensory needs, their sensory profile, what triggers them, how are they at transitions, what are their preferred foods, their safe foods, what is their preferred communication style? Get to know all of that, because then the child will then feel heard, and then they'll trust you and they'll build that connection with you, and then they'll feel safe.
Yeah, there's loads of things I want to touch on that you've spoke about just then. One being when you said about saying to a child the way you are is amazing, like as you are. We all see it in the news a lot. Children's mental health is really at probably the worst it's ever been. And having that neuroaffirming and weeks like this where we can celebrate is so important for that kind of thing as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And children, even as young as 3 and 4, will pick up what adults around them are telling them they need to be like, or how they need to behave, or that they need to stop their stims, or they need to comply with certain things. And I always talk about listening to the voice of the child, and that may be their verbal communication to you, their response to your instructions or your expectations. And then we all know that also their voice comes out through their behaviors. So really tune into those to support you in providing a space where they can be their true authentic self, because you're right, masking has massive implications for children's mental health and well-being. I see it with my two children. They know how they should and shouldn't be, and what they have to almost kind of hide and keep away. You know, my eldest has a couple of fidgets in his blazer pocket, and when things get too much, he doesn't get it out. He stims a lot, but he knows that he can't get away with that as a 6-foot 16-year-old in secondary school. But he still has to, you know, he still has to get it out somewhere and stim somehow. But he's masking heavily, and you see it every day. And I've seen it in our preschoolers. So yeah, just be really tuned in.
Definitely. And something else you said there as well is about looking at your own behaviour and what you do. So it's about sort of flipping the mirror of not just looking at a child's actions, but your own. So how is that beneficial for an educator or a Senko?
I think and it's not saying that, you know, people are doing things wrong, or, you know, it's certainly not. There is some amazing neuroaffirming practice going on out there within it. I mean, I'm in nurseries up and down the country, and you know, I've been in some over the recently over the last couple of weeks, and it's just honestly beautiful, beautiful to watch. It really, really is. But there is still some practice that needs a shift. So it is, I mean, I've been doing this a long, long time. 30 years I've been in the sector, and I would say I've probably learned the most over the last year than I've probably done in that whole period of time, because it's making sure that you are constantly reviewing and reflecting. Do not ever stop learning. And for me, I always make sure, I mean, I'm a neurotypical mum raising neurodivergent boys. I'm sharing the experiences and the voice of my child in the work that I do, but I want to make sure that I have the autistic voice, the ADHD voice, the PDA voice in everything that I do, because I want those voices to be heard, and I want to learn from those neurodivergent adults that are telling us now, because we have more and more adults with their coming through with late diagnosis, and we are learning so much more from them as to what they need to thrive, what they did need and didn't get in their early years and in their early education. So it's ensuring that we are open to new learnings, that we are open to reflection, that we are open to changing our narrative. Early years doesn't stay still. I mean, just look at the early years foundation stage. I mean, it's changing every 5 minutes, it feels. We have to keep going with the learning, with the reflection, with the reviewing, because our children of today are very, very different to the children we had even 2, 5 years ago. Our children in our early year spaces are now very different children to maybe who they were when some of us qualified 30 years ago. And we have to make sure we are on that learning journey and we are open to the idea that maybe we do have to see things differently. Maybe we do have to do things differently. Maybe the star charts and the clouds and the rainbows that are used as behavioral approaches are not the best ones to use anymore. Maybe we do need to have more of this neuroaffirming relational approach in our connection with our children. Maybe that's what our children need now to what our children were. Well, I would suggest they didn't even need that, the behaviorist approach before anyway. But, our children are different. And, there are more children now with neurodivergent conditions in, or emerging neurodivergent conditions. And we have to upskill ourselves to build up our kind of toolbox of strategies and support solutions and our narrative that enables them to flourish. So yeah, don't ever stay stagnant. Just keep your eyes and ears open and just take it all in.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned just there about charts, and before we were recording, you said about the ABC chart, which is often used in early years, and you've sort of made a bit of an adaptation to it. So could you explain how you've done that and like why it's your version's sort of neuro-affirming?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I was going around, so I trained staff, but I also go and spend some time as a consultant within settings, and we'll often talk about behaviors and okay, well, how are you understanding the triggers? And oh, we do an ABC chart. Okay. And actually, when I was speaking a couple of weeks ago at an event, and I had 170 people in front of me, and I asked who uses an ABC chart, and the majority of the people raised their hand. And I asked, the next question I asked was, who can tell me what the A means or what the A stands for? One lady put her hand up. And I said to this lady, I put her on the spot, bless her. I don't like doing it, but I said, do you know what antecedent means? And she said, trigger. Nobody else in the room did. So it's using words that nobody really understands. But also it goes antecedent, behavior, consequence. And consequence very much has a negative connotation. So consequence, what consequence do we place on that child because they have behaved this way? And as much as it may provide that pattern and it may help us to see the trigger, for me, it's not a neuroaffirming approach to understanding what might be going on for that child. So, yeah, I developed a trust form, which has the same layout, the T, the R, the U, the S, and the D at the top, and you can put the dates and all of those things. But the T stands for trigger. So therefore we all know what the word means. And the trigger could be environmental, it could be sensory, it could be because of a transition, it could be because their trusted adult isn't in the room. Could even be that it's windy outside and or raining, and for some of our children with sensory sensitivities, the rain hurts their skin, and that may well be have been a trigger for arriving to you in the morning in meltdown. The R is response. So what was the child's response? What behavior are you seeing right now? Are you seeing meltdown? Are you seeing lashing out? Are you seeing withdrawn? What is the response from that child because of that trigger? The you then is understanding the behavior. And we always talk about the why. Why is that behavior happening? What is it about that behavior. What could be the reason why? So, understanding the behavior. The S then is the support required. What support does the child need right now from us as an adult in this moment? And then the final T is time for reflection. So, as I said before, constantly reflect on what you're doing. So, as a team, you come together and you go, okay, let's reflect together. What was the trigger? Which of those things actually is a responsibility for us to remove or change or provide some support for that child during transitions? Or how can we support the child in knowing that their trusted adult won't be here today so that we can avoid them walking in the room and looking for that trusted adult? Because every single morning at 8:05, they walk over to their trusted adult, they sit down in the home corner, they have a cuddle in their ear defenders, they decompress from the journey to nursery that morning, then they're set and off they go. So how do we ensure that little Johnny knows that my trusted adult isn't going to be there that morning? So things are going to be a bit different. So we warn and we preempt what might be happening. So yeah, it's more of a neuroaffirming approach that very much looks at uses words that we can understand and helps us actually as practitioners and educators to go, okay, what do I need to do to make it better for that child?
Wow, sounds perfect. I hope people listen to podcasts or use that after. So,
Yeah, it's a download available on my website. So yeah, go find it on
perfect.
there. It's a free download. So yeah, anybody can grab a copy.
And that's brought us to the end. So, I'm going to ask you one last question, which we always ask on the podcast, a little bit of a summary. What are the three key takeaways from this episode?
So for me, it's listen and review. Listen to neuroaffirming practitioners, listen to neuroaffirming podcasts, listen to the voice of neurodivergent adults, so therefore you can learn and review what you are doing and whether or not it is neuroaffirming. Have a bit of a review on your narrative, and so right from your policy to your show rounds with parents, what is that narrative that you're talking about with regards to neurodivergence? And is it strength-based? Is it looking at the positives? I'm very aware as a neurotypical mum, I'm very aware when I'm taking my children out in public of the challenges that my children are facing, certainly when my oldest son was a lot younger. I'm very aware that when he's having a meltdown in the middle of Tesco's, that everybody else is looking and judging me as a parent because my child is a bit, oh, they should be parented properly. You just need to say no. All of those things that come with society that expect your child to behave and be a certain way. I'm very aware that my child faces challenges, but if my children are being cared for in an early years space, I want to hear from you what they are doing and what they are, the progress they have made. And there will be progress every single day. If you're attuned to my child, you will find it. So ensure that you're coming from that strength-based narrative. And then the final one for me, I think, is just a commitment to learning more so that we can do more. And ensure that you are committed to a shift and a change in your narrative. So if you are looking at bringing trainers in, if you are looking at SEND training in any sense of the word for your staff team, if you are working with speech and language therapists or OTs, if you are local authority are recommending certain interventions or practices, are those things neuroaffirming? Are they strength-based? Are they affirming the children and celebrating them right where they are? Or are they there to fix and cure our children to be somebody that they are not? So that real commitment to going, do you know what? We're going to do this and we are going to make sure this is embedded throughout everything that we do because our children deserve that from us. So yeah, listen and review, shift your narrative and that commitment to learning more.
That's great. Cheryl, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
If you enjoyed this episode of the SEND Network podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe. For more information and resources on the topic we spoke about in today's episode, please head over to send-network.co.uk.